Hey Simon, thank you for coming in. You have just such a remarkable background, and it was such a joy seeing you speak at this private CEO summit. really engaged, all of the CEOs and so on. So you definitely have this passion and this ability to excite and energize and be a catalyst for change. And you're having so many different creative innovation happening across so many different venues, and but also with an impact base. So just remarkable. So thank you for coming in and sharing all of this with
Thank
our
you for
audience.
inviting me. This is very exciting, Stephen, to talk to you.
So Simon, my audience is. Because I do a lot of analytics on it, it's primarily CEOs and investors, and I would say those are the two big chunks, and then scientists would be sort of the third bucket, and then engineers, people typically with a technical background, and then I do have also students sometimes, or people early in their careers, and they're looking for some kind of mentorship ideas or career path ideas, things like that. So, because of that audience, all of them are always interested in, what were the inflection points in your life that created this wonderful person that you are today? Maybe there's two or three, and it could have happened when you were like 2 years old, or three, or five, or when you're in college, or afterwards. So.
Oh, so great. It's a great question. So I was born in England. You can tell from my accent, but lived in the Middle East for quite some time. Boarding school. I ended up doing speaking languages, learning French and German. Point being, I traveled around the world, looked at the language from the world from lots of different points of view, and through different languages, and developed kind of a real interest in different people's perspectives. And I think seeing the world from different places, living in different countries, gives you the ability to look at the world in multiple different ways. I had a military career first, and then found my way into consulting and working for the World Economic Forum, and loved the nonprofit world, but felt that I needed to kind of learn the business skills to make a real impact. And that's how I ended up at Salesforce. And I just ended up at Salesforce at the time when it was small and exploding in growth. And so I ended up 14 years in Salesforce, from it growing from 2,000 people to nearly 80,000 people. And having multiple roles in that organization taught me so much. I saw a company over all of its different arcs of growth. But I was just really excited at the end of that to get back to where I am now. So my journey has been really weird, with not much logic that I could clearly express. I think I just said yes to every opportunity, and it's taken me to this moment in front of you.
Well, I can definitely see this idea of diversity inclusion. You have this very inclusive way about you in terms of the way you interact and how you do your work. And I find in prior interviews I've done, people who traveled a lot or speak multiple languages, and you're fluent in multiple languages and so on, I find they tend to be more inclusive, and because of that, I guess that variety of experience, and I guess the military would have given you some insights because it's so structured. And then the World Economic Forum, there's sort of very broad thinking, and they, interacting with all these different leaders. And thought leadership would have that mindset. And then, as you mentioned, this journey you've had with Salesforce from its very early beginnings to becoming quite a prominent force in the world today. And so I can see all of those elements shaping who you are. So thank you for sharing all of that. Now, can you talk about how you started with time and what you're doing with time?
Well, I was at Salesforce, Chief Innovation Officer there in my last role, and a lot of my time was spent speaking and working with leaders of some of the largest companies in the world. And as many of those companies went into COVID, I was a destabilizing experience for all of them. And so figuring out how they responded, and not only got through COVID but came out of COVID stronger than when they went in, was a really interesting question. And of course, a lot of that is down to technology? Do you have the right type of technology in your organization, especially when you send all of your people from your call center home? How can they be operating at home as effectively, if not more effectively, than before? And so a lot of organizations figured out that their digital strategy wasn't strong as they thought. But one other thing became very, very clear during COVID, and that is that every organization also had to be really strong in its engagement with civil society and its role beyond purely being a business, thinking much more carefully about its role in society. And so it became really clear that any organization that was going to be successful had to have a kind of a proper new DNA, a double helix of not just digital, but also sustainable. And as I started to work on that and got very excited, I think Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, saw that. He called me in. I went over and had lunch with him. And he says, "Why don't you leave Salesforce? Come and join me. Let's build a business focusing on this." And in particular, we were really excited about the mid-market companies, that the largest companies in the world have quite a large amount of resources, the money, the people, the discretionary budget, to be able to say, okay, let's rally around this issue. But when you're a small or mid-sized company, you don't have the luxury of being able to create a dedicated team focusing on sustainability, for example. How can we serve those organizations and give them the same capabilities as big companies became a really exciting question to solve.
And that's really interesting. I guess Mark bought Time too, right?
And Mark owned Time. And so I came over, we bought co2.com, the URL. I became president of Time. And at the same time, CEO of CO2. And we kind of rebranded that Time CO2. And that was really it. And we looked for over the course of all of last year, the focus was really on designing the company and building something that was truly based on trust, because trust is the single most important ingredient if you're really going to engage that group of companies on an issue so important like sustainability. What we found was that every company has to do two things clearly. First, and probably priority number one, is decarbonize, get off the carbon economy, find ways of swapping, you know, very important high carbon activities for low or no carbon activities. But as every company goes on that mission, this doesn't happen overnight. It's very hard for organizations to make that shift. What else should they be doing? Well, they should also be, supporting programs that help others decarbonize, to help others remove carbon out of the atmosphere, reduce their emissions, support biodiversity, and support climate justice. And that's broadly under the rubric of offsetting, although it doesn't have to be. But it's solving that problem, helping companies fund other organizations. And that's where we spent our time, really looking hard at that. And offsetting has been broken for quite some time. According to a Californian study, over 80% of all of the offsets in the carbon market are just junk, is the official term. And then a report came out only a couple of months ago stating that that's 94%. So almost all the carbon credits in the market are junk. That's a terrible statistic. But what's more scary is that how are you supposed to find the good quality if you're a mid-sized company, you don't have expertise, you certainly don't know, who to speak to about this. And even if you did, you'd be spending hundreds of hours on each project. And you'd probably just find one project that you wanted. That is not what a good company should be doing. And so we basically said, let's create a utility that can be the world's best answer to that. We'll go and find the world's best climate scientists, create partnerships with them, create partnerships with top universities, build a team of experts who can go out and rummage through all of these thousands of projects out there, verify them, validate them, do their scientific research, and then pay a lot of consultants. We have layer upon layer of consultants who do all types of technical reviews of these projects as well, in order that we can find ones that we can put our hands on our heart and go, that's about as high quality as you're likely to find in the carbon market. So that was kind of the first thing we did. We really wanted to go and help find those projects and make sure that they were of the very highest quality, according to science. But then it was like, well, what types of companies, what types of projects should we bring together and enable, you know, these small and mid-sized companies to support? And that's where we really started looking at what the planet needs. And we worked very closely with Oxford University, Cambridge University, Stanford, Berkeley, ASU, UCSB, the list goes on of organizations we worked with. But it became very clear that what the planet needs at the scientific level is not just more trees. And that's a lot. That's mostly what companies go and do. Let's go and throw some trees at the problem. Excuse me. What the planet needs is an array of different things. The climate is a system. And so companies need to support that in multiple different ways. And so we built a portfolio that is 40% focused on carbon removals, 30% on carbon emissions reduction, but also 20% on supporting projects that protect old growth forests, mangroves, peatlands, and then 10%, which is pure innovation. We built this portfolio that was really the best systemic answer to the climate problem. And that became our first real product. But the aim behind all of that was, if we could build the world's best answer and make it an easy button so that the average company, without any real effort, could go out and do and get the world's best answer to the problem and serve the planet in the best way, we just make it a layup for them. So that's what we've been focusing on.
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned that typically large companies, multinationals, already have sustainability teams. Mm. They can put the resources towards this. And it's interesting. You know, I'm in weekly meetings and biweekly meetings with these multinational CEO groups. It's all pro bono, so I want to make that clear to the audience. And they mentioned that they're actually well on their way on that sustainability side, and that's really purposeful leadership and so on. But you're saying that there's this gap with small and medium-sized companies because they just don't have that kind of capability. So you've created this trusted portfolios of projects and things that they can get into and realize that it's sort of the best in the world today and get involved in some way. So what will that involvement entail? So let's say they go to CO2.com and they see something that's really interesting. What's the next step?
So the next, we didn't want there to be lots of next steps. These companies, we didn't want there to be lots of choice either. That was one feedback we got. It's like, the more choice you give us, the more confused we are again. So we said, we built Planet's portfolio. And we went out and we worked with some amazing scientists on building this. And if you go to CO2.com, you literally scroll down, click on the portfolio, see it, and then decide how much you want to fund. And then it becomes a question of, well, how much you want to spend on this versus the other things you should be doing. And this is where there's a broader climate journey that every company needs to go on. And for large companies, you've got multiple different things you're doing. You have an array of different activities ranging from supporting charities to perhaps you've got a fund. You've got an innovation fund, you might have some offsetting, you have lots of different things going on in a very large company focusing on climate, employee engagement, etc. For a small company, you might not have anything. And so what do you do? Well, we do want every company on the planet, irrespective of what industry they're in, to be looking inside their organization going, what are the no-brainer things that I should be doing to reduce my carbon footprint? So that's the first thing every company should be doing. But once you've figured out that there are only a few levers you can pull this year, then it's like, what's your carbon footprint that you have remaining? And let's say it's 100 tons. And there are different tools that enable you to go and find out what that footprint is. We're building one ourselves and we'll have that soon. You now know how much footprint is kind of your problem. And then you go to CO2.com, put in that number, and it'll tell you what you need to spend. And we work on $50 per ton, which is the appropriate price for a ton of carbon that's removed out of the atmosphere. And you use that and you invest that money. So 100 tons times 50, and that gives you your budget. Plumb that in. And what you get back is not just you know, a good feeling and the money goes out of your account. What you get back is a dashboard that shows you your impact. And that's not just the tons of carbon that you bought 100 tons of carbon, let's say in this instance, but what you get back is a dashboard that gives you the clear statistics, the information on how many tons of carbon were removed, how many tons of CO2 were reduced, pulled out of the atmosphere from through other projects reduced. And then third, how many tons of carbon was protected in old growth forests. But you also have metrics for your impact on nature and biodiversity. And third, on community and climate justice. So we wanted to make it really clear that that money was not just buying carbon offsets, but actually having a material measurable impact on different things in the world of carbon, different things in the world of nature, and different things in the world of climate justice. And that dashboard is, of course, then copyable, pasteable, put it into your annual report. And then on top of that, we then send you information, studies, stories of what your money is doing in these projects and how these projects are evolving over the course of the year. Because this isn't just about throwing money at the problem. This is about activating your employees, your customers, your investors in your excitement about being a company that's supporting nature. So we wanted to give companies the tools to be really articulate about how they're supporting these projects and what these projects are actually doing. And that was the big learning for us. When we started, we thought, let's just go and build the world's best portfolio, give it to companies, and then they'll feel they've done it really well, like kind of the checkbox. But what was the big learning for us was these companies, yes, they wanted that, and they wanted it of the highest order of quality, but they needed to be able to talk about it. And that was a really big learning for us, that the communications tools, the proof and the stories that we give them were as, if not more important than the actual project itself.
That's really fascinating. So you're about to release a tool so they can measure what their sort of issues are from a carbon standpoint, carbon footprint. And then you have the ability to get really trusted investments in this area where they can do offsets. And like you said, over 90% is junk, and you vetted all of this to make sure it's pure. It's very good. And then they get this dashboard so they can monitor it. And as you mentioned, put it into their annual reports and monthly reports to their employees. They can do communications on it. And then there's this sort of mass communication sort of synergy that occurs on companies that decide to engage. And are you going to then, as time, produce a cumulative report and maybe do a sort of an annual CO2 report of the results in some way?
Absolutely. This is all, when you look at the climate problem, you know, at the heart of it, it's a communication problem, honestly. So yes is the answer. We will be absolutely producing a report on the CO2 portfolio in multiple different ways, bringing these stories to life. We're building other portfolios, enormous amounts of storytelling that can be done around what we call these ecopreneurs out there that these companies are supporting. And of course, we're telling the stories of projects that have a truly high quality output, verifiable output. But what's really exciting is that as we've gone on this journey, back to your whole point about storytelling, is what we found is most organizations don't know where to start on their climate journey. They are just lost, and they get it. They know that they've got to do something. And in many cases, they've got really, really big supply chain champions who, you know, they're their big customers who are pleading with them, begging them. Some of the largest companies in the world at the CEO level, one of the single most large problems is, how do we get the supply chain? How do we get all these small and medium-sized businesses to reduce their carbon footprint? This is the Scope 3 footprint of the large companies. And it's really, really hard. And they're begging these small companies to measure their footprint, provide the data, and so that they can help them with programs reduce their footprint, but they're not. And the trick is here, or the problem here is that these small companies, they just, first of all, they don't want to surrender their data because they don't know how that data will be used. And second, they don't know what to do. Like, they've been given guidance, but they can't turn that guidance into action. They can't connect spending a lot of money on climate action that they don't really understand what to do with business value in their organization. And they don't know exactly what to do. They're time poor. They don't have a lot of resources. And so what they really need are stories, not just stories of the projects that Time CO2's got in its portfolio. They need stories of companies like them who and what they're doing. How are companies like them, you know, moving to renewable energy? How are companies like them, you know, virtualizing that IT or swapping from a diesel fleets to an electric fleet? What specifically are they doing that can be copyable? And they don't want these stories locked up in 50-page PDFs, but that's where they are today. They are locked, doomed. And nobody was going to read a PDF of that size and actually execute it. We will not PDF ourselves to climate action that way. And so the storytelling becomes enormously important. And the reason I'm saying all of that, Stephen, is that as we look at that problem at Time has built the portfolio, and that becomes the easy button to supercharge organizations' ability to go and do offsetting properly, go beyond offsetting easily. But we also want to help companies with that bigger problem. And so a large part of what you'll see coming out of Time is not just the stories around the portfolios, but stories around all of these mid-sized companies and what they're doing on their climate journey. Simple stuff that makes sense. Here's how I invested it. Here's my impact on climate, but here's how it made business sense for me. And those stories, we need thousands of those stories. We need them to be at the fingertips of all of these businesses. That will create the movement. That will enable these companies to actually act with confidence.
That's really, really interesting. In fact, I'm engaged in supporting pro bono, as I mentioned, these multinational CEOs and with a group called the CEO Leadership Alliance. And then they're working on a national collaborative of 25 leadership groups. But they could then embrace this and suggest to their thousands of supply chain companies to embrace it as well, right? As
a 100%, 100%. And so take any supply chain leader. They may have 100,000 suppliers.
Right.
They probably have a lot of projects already running, doing everything they can to persuade, cajole, push, force those 100,000 organizations to move. It's just difficult. And by the way, there's a lot of great work that's there. There's a lot of fantastic information, a lot of great subsidies, a lot of great benefits, but the companies aren't moving. It's a communication challenge. But now imagine turning a media engine at that supply chain and campaigning it into action, taking that amazing insights that's locked and hidden in PDFs and translating it into insights that the average person will read and go, wow, this is awesome. While on the bus, reading it with flipping through with their thumb, send it to the team, and the team will read it and action it. That won't happen with a PDF, but it could happen with a campaign-based approach where information flows to the leaders in those organizations and their teams in just the right time, in just the right way. Information that will help them make really good decisions. Information that will help them, you know, figure out how to improve the credit score, the credit rating of their business, or make simple changes. And it's not just the how-to information they need. They need the stories of what others are doing. So that's a large part of where we've been focusing our time behind the scenes as well. And of course, that's led us into all types of incredible partnerships, because this isn't something that Time can do on its own. We're partnering with some of the very best universities, the very best NGOs, working really closely with WBCSD, with the We Mean Business Coalition and the SME Climate Hub, with the World Economic Forum, and of course, all of these universities as well. So there's an enormous amounts of incredible partners that are out there. But if they can all come together in kind of like an Avengers, and then they can be at service of that supply chain leader we were just talking about, in the context of a media-driven kind of campaign, that can really change the game in these supply chains.
You mentioned earlier, or you were at a YPO, a sort of a private YPO Global Impact Summit, and some of this went public. So that's the reason we could talk about it, right? They posted on it. And so that's one of the largest private CEO leadership communities, and you have a relationship with them prior to this. And so that's a great program, right, for that community. Yes. Have you reached out to the entrepreneurship community as well? There's an entrepreneurship org, and there's others, Startup Without Borders, and others that are maybe more earlier in their journey to get them engaged in some way.
I haven't yet, actually, but that's a fantastic idea. The truth, well, just to underline your point about the YPO, the Young Presidents Organization, the YPO, is an incredible organization. I've got immense amount of respect for them. And there are thousands of organizations in the YPO who are already well and truly on their climate journey, doing amazing things. And yet their story is not known. And if more people knew some of the incredible things those individual companies are doing, and in many cases, not on their own, but together in groups, it would be very, very inspiring to others as well. But this is something that entrepreneurs, and there are great entrepreneurs who are fixing problems, creating the future that people don't know about. I think one of the most interesting observations we've had on this journey is that there are many organizations out there with incredible leaders, incredible teams who are working 25 hours a day, improving their business, doing everything they can to make a living. And they are incrementally improving their business every day. That taking that wing nut, cranking it one more turn to the right every day. And they won't survive in the world that is being created. The climate crisis is so severe that whole industries will fundamentally reinvent themselves off the carbon economy into the new world. The world of air transport will lead to whole different powertrains for aircraft, whole different aircraft types, which will lead to whole different types of airports. We won't need massive hubs as much. This will redistribute how the infrastructure is today. It'll change the face of that industry. Every industry is going through the same. Trucking, agriculture, retail. They're all going through enormous changes, but sometimes those changes are 1 degree separated from the players in the industry, and they don't see the change that's coming. And so you're going to be on the wrong side of history or on the right side of history if you're either preparing for that change and getting ready for it and moving now and starting to really get to grips with what that change is going to mean for your business, or you're just cranking away, turning that wing nut one crank to the right and optimizing your business into yesterday and off a cliff. So we're seeing that divergence happen, and we don't want people to fail. So we need to inspire them to understand the changes that are happening, see what they can do, see how the change that they need to make can become really powerful for the future of their business.
So Simon, and to the audience, all of my interviews are unscripted. So I'm just going to do a time check. I was assuming we had an hour, but I want to make sure that we do have an hour.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. That's great. You know, I work with a lot of governments. In fact, I work on sovereign fund investment committee work as well. And I can only talk about it because some of it is under security, requires security clearance, and which I have only when they go public. And I only talk about what they go public on. And of course, governments are really interesting in enabling business and making direct investments and doing fund of funds and directly to VCs. And they're investing directly in companies as well. And so are you reaching out to governments to see if, you know, because this is such a seamless platform and tools and so on, and it's trusted that you built because you've got your brand behind it. So you want to make sure it is trusted. Have you reached out to the 193 governments that are part of the UN sort of ecosystem?
Well, so the answer is yes, but I left Salesforce in January last year. I've built an incredible team, but it's still quite small. And so we haven't yet stretched all the way into full government engagement, which there's a lot of people you need to speak to, and suddenly you need a very large team. That said, we are working with the US Department of State. We have some phenomenal conversations with them. They're doing some really interesting things around the Energy Transition Accelerator. What we've been less focused so much on the government side of things as actually working really closely with a large number of the non-governmental organizations who are the nonprofits who are orbiting around the kind of building the trust engine around the carbon markets. So the Science-Based Targets Initiative, the SBTI, is used by many large organizations as kind of a validator of their climate progress. And the SBTI has been doing a lot to evolve its thinking on and guidance to companies on how to not only do, you know, the decarbonization within their business, but also how to think about carbon credits. We've been working very closely with the Voluntary Carbon Markets Initiative, the VCMI, and the ICVCM. There's a lot of acronyms in this universe, all of whom are amazing organizations comprised of top climate scientists from different parts of the world and people from other nonprofits like the CDP. And they're all coming together to really try and put more structure, more rigor around things like the carbon markets so that more people can engage with more confidence in that. So we're heavily involved in those with those organizations. But governments are incredibly important. We know that, for example, the work that that led to the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, was amazing. And it's now triggered incredible amounts of innovation in the US. And now in the European Union, they're enacting a similar approach, which will again spark innovation around climate action. Back to the points I was making earlier, the future is going to be so interesting and so vibrant, but we need to innovate our way there. And government can help by putting in place legislation that inspires that change. But ultimately, this, and John Kerry says this a lot, underlines this point a lot, if we're really going to solve the climate crisis, we cannot sit down and wait for government to do it for us. Business is the single most powerful tool that we have on the planet. The markets are the single most powerful tool we have to actually create change, because that's where we need like $3 to $5 trillion every year for the next 30 years to be plowed into infrastructure. That money's not going to come from governments. It's not going to come from taxes like that. It's got to come from businesses understanding that they can make those changes, and those changes will drive business value for them. And it needs consumers to understand and support that. And so that, I think, is kind of the change that we're seeing happening.
So I can see you have all of these different threads, like a mycelium web of change out there of partners and so on. So you can use people like ourselves who are engage in different government programs and that are out there in the audience as well. I'm just thinking sovereign funds would be a good one, because they are investing in lots of companies, or companies like BlackRock, which have what, 9 to 10 trillion. I know their portfolio has dropped a bit, but maybe 9 to 10 trillion of investments and things like that. Are you working with those investment groups at all directly?
Yes. Well, in a number of different ways. We're in conversation with a lot of them, because they themselves also, you know, value us as a service. We're back office. We're basically a back office that goes out and finds the very best high quality projects and makes sense of them. And in many cases, that's a service that many of these organizations can use as well. So on that side, we're also finding that a lot of these financial institutions have got a large, you know, they've got a large book of business. They've got a large number of investments that they've made, and they're financed emissions. That's their scope 3 problem. And they're looking at all of the organizations that they've invested in going, how do we help reduce the footprint of those companies? Which again is exactly the same problem that we're solving in a different way. How do we help those small and mid-sized businesses that we're investing in reduce their carbon footprint? And when they do that, a lot of they're giving them advice. They're telling them things they can do. They're telling them what they can do to decarbonize. But all of those businesses also will have a remaining footprint that they can't reduce themselves, that they want to buy offsets for, but they want to buy high quality offsets. And so we are becoming the partner to many of those financial institutions to be their kind of high quality offset provider as a service to their their supply chain, their investment companies.
Have you connected with Michael Meehan, who chairs this UK Financial Sustainability Alliance?
No, I haven't.
I think they represent about 15 trillion US in assets under management. So I've done an interview with them where he says that it's really difficult to find trusted groups where they can do investments and so on. So I think Michael Meehan would be a good one to connect with.
I love that. And honestly, Stephen, that's what we spent so much of last year doing, was going out and building trust,
right?
Building trust that we weren't out selling. We were out going, how do we build something that stands the trust test? And, you know, getting people like Johan Rockström to be an advisor to us, Catherine Hayhoe to be an advisor to us, was for us a enormous moment, because we couldn't have done that unless we had really proven success on many, many multiple occasions that what we were doing was very genuine, authentically focusing on trust. And so I love that you pointed to that, and I've just written Michael's name down. I'd love to connect with him after this.
The other day I had a meeting with Chris DeGoya, who's the founder of Leaders on Purpose, and they did one of the original studies, Purposeful Leaders, that are multinationals, and it was a private report, some of it where they interviewed them, and then they produce a report, and they're going to do a re-up of that report in a new cohort. Definitely that community would be one that you'd probably be interested in connecting with, especially from a supply chain standpoint.
Mm.
And they're already on that journey. There's the Danish Management Society as well. They're 4 to 5 years into making sure that all of their 4,000 companies are embedded in this sustainability journey. So they're quite sophisticated, and they even released a dashboard tool to monitor this work. And they must have now over 1,000 use cases that they share internally. So I think they would be a good one for you to connect with. And then, as I mentioned, the sovereign funds, some of the really big ones are now looking at, like the Norwegian Sovereign Fund and others. They're really, actually all of them, especially the Western ones too, are looking at how can we be sustainable in what we're doing? And then because they're doing such massive investments and doing recommendations to all of the VCs that they invest in and the fund of funds that invest in indirect investments, then it's a way of, especially because it's a trusted tool and it's easy, it's already available and so on. I mean, I would go after them. I mean, I'm just percolating with lots of thought. There's a CEO founder in Southeast Asia. Her name is Thipaporn. She's out of Thailand. Her name is, we call her Kun B, or B for short. She definitely is the beacon in that region, but she's also part of the CP Group family. And I would say that what she's doing is a beacon for all of the conglomerates that they're working, that they have. I think they have about 20 conglomerates. So definitely somebody to try to maybe get in as an advisor. And she has, in the first 15 interviews the Leaders on Purpose did, this program at Harvard, the World Bank, and Unilever, she was one of the CEOs interviewed because she is so progressive in her thinking on sustainability. Yeah. I'm actually heading out to meet with them in a few weeks. I'll mention this, but I think, God, if you got her involved, I think she can open up many, many different regions, because they got investments throughout the world, including now into India and Africa and so on. So, I mean, I'm thinking of maybe 100 different groups that would love what you're doing. And then, you know, the audience could be your ambassadors, right? Because you created this wonderful platform, tools and so on for engagement, right? And trusted investment, in essence, to bring peace of mind. And as you mentioned, they could, all these narratives they can share, and then it could just percolate like exponentially, right? So I just love all of these, all of this work that you're doing. Let's now kind of shift this conversation, and where do you see climate going, and all of the different ramifications of climate, from clean energy and energy sources and so on to new kinds of ways of computation, like quantum computing. There's analog computing that can maybe address new materials, new kinds of batteries, or or ways to address climate. You saw Bill Gates last year talk about how on the agricultural side of climate that he's thinking of the best way to address it is through new hybrid seeds. For example, you have the World Food Program, and they have this 100 billion meals idea because that's associated with climate. You have the health situation occurring around the world because of climate. There's the tipping points, of course, the this massive glacier ice mass in Antarctica is progressing much faster in some ways than they think, and maybe could degrade much faster than they originally thought. There's all of the fossil carbon that there's these massive cracks that are appearing in Siberia and so on that can really, again, can accelerate all of what's happening, maybe much faster. What are your thoughts on all of these elements? And then the innovation that's occurring, one that I think I mentioned earlier in a private conversation with you, and I did an article on them, and that's the University of California, Irvine, where the entire school and all Ontario University and all 14 schools of that university, and there's two Nobel Prize winners within that ecosystem, the entire community has said, we're going to address this. Because we're basically a city as well. They have their own power plants, their own bus system. The entire university is now, and all of their schools are going to address this en masse. And for what I believe, they're probably the only one right now in the world that's doing this as an entire ecosystem. And James Bullock is embedded into that. Again, happy to do introductions as well, but cool. So what are your views on this? You know, ways to address it? Are we at past the tipping points and so on? So,
well, maybe you start on the negative first. I mean, I didn't realize this when I got into this fully, just how serious climate depression is. If you're a climate scientist or somebody who's living day to day in this universe, you're exposed to the true facts of the impact of climate change already on our planet and the proximate nature of further devastating tipping points, it's easy to be very depressed. And the truth is that there's a lot of very depressed people as a result of really understanding the situation. We are in a world where we are already experiencing terrible impacts to people's lives, not necessarily as much in the developed world, but certainly already in the developing world. So we're already seeing an unfair just sort of distribution of the impact of climate change. So this is not something that will happen to us soon. It has already happened, and it's just a matter of how much worse it's going to get and can we improve it, which is a kind of a depressing thought. But flipping to the good side, I truly believe that we as humanity will not survive this, but we will innovate and thrive through it. But we need to fix this not just with enormous amounts of innovation, but with enormous amounts of compassion as well, because it truly has divided the planet. And those who have caused the problem are reaping less of the impact than those who haven't, who are reaping more of the impact right now. And similarly, we can't be telling the developing nations what to do and how they should get off carbon immediately when they're just trying to figure out how, you know, they evolve and increase the quality of their life and fight through some of the changes that are going on to their societies. But with that said, there is enormous hope. There is incredible innovation in every aspect of human life. And it starts in the agricultural, because if you can't eat, you can't feed others, then we have major problems. And we know that not just through the Ukraine war, but through some devastating droughts, that there's been real disruption to, you know, the world's food systems. And that has already had major problems. And we know that that's going to get worse over time. We know we're going to have to innovate there in order to be able to feed populations. We also know that there are large tracts of land that are no longer going to be able to support farming because of temperature change. So we need to be able to either find new crops that can be grown there, or we need to grow crops in other places that we haven't grown crops in before. And that's going to need innovation at that level. And there's a whole bunch of great work that's going on there. But we also need to look at the agricultural system that we have today and innovate that. We have been waging war on the top 6 inches of our planet, the top 6 inches of our earth, with pesticides and insecticides and fertilizers that are all basically a derivative of chemical programs that were developed during the war. Those companies that developed those as basically to, you know, win wars, those companies now became insecticide and pesticide companies, and we've been waging war on our planet. And the top 6 inches of our planet, that soil, is pretty much completely depleted. We are so close to turning our soil into desert all around the world just by the farming techniques we've been using for decades. So there's really exciting changes as people figure out new models of farming. So that's on the food and agriculture side, and really saying, how can we reinvent how we think about soil? And we need a lot more motion there. We need to support farmers to make that transition. And I'm hopeful that we'll do that. The energy system also is incredibly important. The fuel that what's driven all of these economic changes that have happened, what's driven the First Industrial Revolution, Second Industrial Revolution, Third Industrial Revolution, Fourth Industrial Revolution, each of those have been driven by carbon, by fossil fuels. We cannot have the Fifth Industrial Revolution driven by fossil fuels. We need new forms of fuel. And it's really exciting that now solar is cheaper than petrol, but we need to do a lot more to disseminate electrification and enable people to buy vehicles and be able to charge them wherever they live. But we're making good progress there. And then you've got innovation across every other aspect of life. Innovation in retail through the circular economy. It's amazing what IKEA is doing now to recycle mattresses. So every part of our life could be recycled. And if we start to look at the world as everything is recyclable, we'll break this consumption mental model that we've built over the last 60 years and reinvent how we think about consumerism. So I think there's a lot of innovation, a lot of great technologies. Honestly, if we can solve nuclear fission, then job done. But putting that to one side, there's a lot of great innovation.
Yeah, I guess you're also talking about nuclear fusion, where
fusion as well. Yes.
Yeah, where you can get maybe more positive out energy that we're putting in, and we've had some sort of breaking innovation that's made some great news worldwide. I think at Lawrence Livermore and some of the U.S. laboratories, for example.
Yes.
Maybe that they're doing in France. On the biomedical innovation side, in fact, a week after next, I'm speaking at this TerraSec Institute of Biomedical Innovation Summit, and I'm on their leadership board, and we've created a way to culture meat, so you don't have to have animals. You can actually grow them in bioreactors. And in fact, that's probably going to be a topic area. So there's a lot of innovation on the biomedical side. I'll mention your work, by the way, because they're very much interested in climate, and your work very much resonate with what they're doing as well. So, okay, now let's go sort of, what's the best case for you?
Best case.
You know, let's say in the short term, let's say by 2025.
The best case is that, a lot of organizations really decide that to get on their climate journey, and that they look at what they can do inside their organization and they start making material changes and start making changes that reduce their carbon footprint year over year by greater than 7.5%, which is kind of carbon law. At the same time, they look at what they're not being able to reduce, and they decide that they're going to go and support programs with the highest order of quality, and then they come to us, and we become their service provider. We don't want to just work with individuals. We want to work with whole supply chains. And then we'll have supply chain leaders come to us and say, hey, we want to build a portfolio for our industry. And, you know, we're Pepsi, Coke and Diageo, and we got together and we've got between us 450,000 suppliers. We need a portfolio, and you guys provide us that portfolio. And we go and build a portfolio that's designed specifically to serve the needs and interests of their business. And similarly, we end up working with different focus groups. We find that there's a really big group of companies that desperately want to support the ocean. And we've already half built our ocean portfolio. So we're working to serve those organizations. And then at the same time, time is also really out there understanding and capturing the stories of the average company and what they're doing on their climate journey, and capturing that in a simple way, cataloging it, and enabling others to benefit from those stories. And that's a big part of what I want to do, is become the storyteller for all those organizations who are on their journey, celebrate the progress that they're making in order that they can celebrate their progress to their customers, help them legitimize their progress to their customers, and then create a movement of companies moving on the journey. And that will be the most important thing. We have to create a movement of companies who are just, and this is not the companies who are out there at the bleeding edge getting the gold medal for the triathlon that they've just won, because there's only ever going to be one of those winners. I'm talking about the average company. I'm talking about the company that everybody's looking at going, hey, I could do that too. Why did nobody ever explain it to me that easily that I could do this? Why aren't we doing it like that? Why are we not? How can we create this feeling across boards all over the world of like, are we the only ones not moving? That is what I would love us to do.
I guess with small and medium-sized companies too, I'm seeing they're feeling the pressure of their children, and who are either Gen Z or Alpha Generation. Gen Z, let's say 1997, forward, or Gen Alpha Generation 2012 and forward. So, and that's forcing them to rethink what they're doing with their existing companies and moving in this direction, right? I mean, ultimately, the newer or younger generation are very much engaged, much more than the older generation. So that will drive some of this, right? And it's not a situation where you can ignore it. You have to start engaging in some way and thinking about this in some way. And you created this way that they can get involved. They can. It's much simpler for them. It's not, how do I do it? And it's a fog. You've laid out a complete pathway, a framework, and then also ways to execute and to measure it, and then to share that narrative so that it spreads, right? So do you think about that as well from...
Oh my goodness, all the time.
Are you speaking at like Younga, the Young General Assembly, or the One World, which is of two youth, or YNG, which is the 22 to 25,000 YPOers who are the children of YPOers, to engage back in it. Because then they can talk to their parents and say, hey, who own companies, right?
This is... Yes. So the answer is no, not yet, but I'm kicking myself as I'm hearing you talk, because honestly, one of the reasons why I'm even doing this, why I'm sat here talking about it like this, is because of my children. And I'm like, what am I doing with my life? I'm a successful professional, but what am I doing for them? And really, you could distill it down to, I'm basically working in a company as part of an economy that is taking their future away from them. Because the old economy is doing nothing but shortchanging the future economies. We are, over the last 40 years, one of the single most impactful things that my generation has done, us as leaders, is kill half of all life on the planet. What a great legacy that is. We are stealing out of our kids' piggy banks now in order to fuel our life, and we're ripping them off. And it's no wonder that these youth organizations are now exist with voice, because they are pissed, and they have all the right to be. And it's correct that we should have them at the table. They are, because they are angry with all the justifications. So yes, and I'm seeing more CEOs who are like, my daughter has shamed me into this and I feel so bad. It took her so long. The power of the daughter, the power of the children to get these CEOs to wake up and smell the coffee and realize we can't do this is really important. And as we look right now at the organizations who are prepared to even listen to us, it's not every company in the world. It's not every CEO in the world. Most CEOs don't have those daughters tapping them on the shoulder, unfortunately. And we see this kind of bell curve distribution, the Pareto curve. And at the forward edge of that is like organizations who are prepared to act now. These are CEOs who wake up, leap out of bed and be like, we're doing this. I don't care. We will figure out the economics of this. We have to do it. It's the right thing to do. Behind them is this group called the fast follower. These are CEOs who are like, I don't know if this is a good idea, but if those guys do well, I'm going to follow quickly and probably do it better than them and make some money. And then you've got the middle of the market. This group is largely inactive right now. They are not activated. And we need to do something to engineer them to wake up and smell the coffee. And then you've got the laggards at the back. These are organizations who, even when we set their roof on fire, they won't leave their home and get on the bandwagon. Those organizations, I think, will probably just become, they will be on the wrong side of history and will become irrelevant very quickly to society. Society will revoke their license to do business by not buying from them. So it's, how do we serve these early adopters and these fast followers and make them successful? And those organizations in large part have been activated by the youth generation or are formed and built by those people, because the millennials now, Gen Z is now the largest workforce. If you're a CEO trying to win the war for talent, you have to be relevant to Gen Z. You have to. I just posted on Twitter yesterday that there's this whole movement. There's this whole movement called conscious quitting. These millennials, it's not just their first job now. They're quitting their jobs if they're working for an organization that doesn't have strong values and positive, provable, verifiable action towards values-based approaches to society, climate action, for example. Wow, I got really excited about that, but it's a really big point.
Yeah, and in fact, that's what I'm thinking. You should speak to the YNGers, the One World community, and the Youngas are the Young General Assembly, which is connected to the United Nations, right? So those three, you'll hit tens of thousands, over 100.
Totally, yes.
So, and you get them driving, and they have so much energy, right? So.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, because they want it done properly. And right now, there are business people who are going, well, we should buy carbon credits. And what they're doing is just going finding the cheapest carbon credits, which is complete. You might as well just drive down the road and throw tree seeds out of your car window. It's as valuable and impactful to the planet as that. This is not a time for cheapness. We need to do it properly.
Absolutely. So we're down to the last couple of minutes of our interview, the hour that's been allocated. So and the last question is, what's your closing recommendations to our broad audience?
my first point is, go to co2.com and call me, simon@co2.com. Easy to find. And but get on the climate journey and let us know what's hard, because we want to make it easy. And I mean that just in general, like through time, what stories can we tell of others? Who have already, if you've got a great story, share it. That's what we need. We need storytelling. And part of what I'm trying to do is just find easy buttons to make it easy for companies who are finding it hard to move to get going. Thank you very much, Stephen.
It just occurred to me one other thought. Did you connect with Taha of the Goodwill? Because he's got 22 million on his platform, right? And so, poor young people.
I love Taha. He and I spent a lot of time together.
Oh, okay.
He's got the energy of 50 people, and he's built an amazing community that is truly world-class. And I want to do everything I can to make him successful.
Okay, that's great. You did connect.
Yes, big time. Yeah.
Okay, so again, thank you for coming in and sharing so many of your insights and journey with our audience. I just really enjoyed our dialogue. And as I mentioned to the audience, it's all unscripted. So thank you again.
Thank you, Stephen, very much.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the Brand Called You.